Welcome to Barron Talks, where I have discussions with interesting people in the Penn State Barron community. I am Dr. Ralph Ford, Chancellor of Penn State Barron. My guest today is Dr. Sherry Mason. Sherry is our Sustainability Coordinator at Penn State Barron. So, Sherry, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me, and feel free to call me Sam.
Well, I will. I know we call you that all, you know, commonly, you are Dr. Sherry Mason, but we'll call you Sam for the remainder of the show. But let me do a little background though on your bio. It's very impressive. You hold a bachelor's in chemistry from the University of Texas, Austin, a PhD in physical chemistry from the University of Montana. You came to us from SUNY Fredonia. You've been at the University of Waterloo, Minnesota, Montana. But I'm going to go a little further. Your work is really well known in microplastics worldwide. This is not an exaggeration. You won the Heinz Public Policy Award in 2018. That's a big deal. Congratulations. You have been featured in the American Scientist and Time Magazine. And I know that's just part of the list, but it's because the work that you're doing is very impactful. And we're going to talk about a lot today. But the first thing I'd like to know, I'll turn this over to you, is, I think you grew up in Texas. Is that correct?
That is correct. I grew up,
How did you end up in Erie? So tell us a bit of your path to Erie, Pennsylvania and Penn State University.
I grew up in Texas, but it's I don't know how much people know about Texas. It's really hot down there, man. So I really wanted to get out of Texas. It was more affordable for me to do my undergrad in Texas. I looked at going out of state, but couldn't afford it. Sadly, had to go to UT Austin, which, you know, in retrospect, I'm like, oh, that's a really good school.
That was a good choice, yeah.
But when I left Austin or graduated from UT Austin, I wanted to move up north. And so I was looking for a smaller community, and I was looking to be up north and in the mountains. And really kind of threw a dart at the board, and Missoula, Montana came up onto my radar. So I kind of on a whim, and much to the chagrin of my parents, just kind of packed up and moved to Montana, having never visited or anything. But I knew that it was a small town. It was in the mountains, and there was a college there. And that's what I was looking for. And didn't really know what I was going to do. And I actually took a gap year, as it's commonly referred, and worked a bunch of not crappy jobs, I cleaned hotel rooms. I was a waitress and a terribly bad one at that. And decided that maybe I should go to grad school. ended up at the University of Montana, to do my PhD. And my first semester in grad school, I took a class called Teaching University Chemistry and realized, oh, so with a PhD, I could become a professor. Like, that's how professors come to being. Like, they're not like handed to us from God. They come into life, in this way and realized that that's really what I wanted to do and was a little bit, unsure prior to that. So I decided I wanted to be a professor. And, during my time in Montana, I loved it there. But it's kind of remote. So I decided that I wanted to move out to the East Coast to be closer to where things are, you know, in closer proximity to each other. Got the job at Fredonia, arrived there and realized I had not made it to the East Coast.
You have not. You're on the edge of the Midwest.
I made it to the Midwest and, But along the shores of the Great Lakes, and I fell in love with them and never wanted to leave this area. So even as I was looking to move out of SUNY Fredonia, really wanted to stay in this region. So I just feel so incredibly blessed that Penn State Barron had a position and I was able to get that. So,
well, let's talk about that position. You are our sustainability coordinator. You teach classes as well, but I'd like to talk about the ambitious goals and ideas that you have in sustainability. So talk about what is that? What is it you're trying to do?
So I think sustainability, let's start with that, because that's the question I get the most. What is sustainability? What do we mean by that? Sustainability means being able to meet our current needs without affecting the ability of future generations to meet theirs, right? And so I think this is really important. A component of it is environmentalism and protecting the environment, because obviously we rely on the environment for everything that we use and need and to survive. But there's an economic component to this, and there's a people component to this too. And I think that's a really important kind of understanding to have. I usually use the analogy that it's really going to be hard to get somebody to care about protecting a tree if they can't feed themselves, right? If they can't, feed their children or their parents and take care of themselves. So you have to have all of these things working in concert to really have a sustainable society.
Well, I really like that definition because it is thinking about future generations, but I think it's hard for people to think that way though, right? It seems it's out there, right? We say that a lot, but you've got to get people to have that into their conscious belief system.
Well, that's what I like about the 17 sustainable development goals that were developed largely through the United Nations and their organization of states adopted in 2015. So these 17 goals really kind of put this lofty idea into kind of, much more tangible form, right? So it starts with no poverty, mm-hmm. gender equity, economic development. You know, these are all components to it, as well as things like climate change and life on land and life below water. Those kind of environmental components that I think people automatically assume are part of sustainability. It also incorporates these other aspects that are much more focused on people, right? Living wage, no poverty, no hunger, and things that are focused on the economic component. So, economic growth, responsible consumption and production, so understanding that all of these things work together.
You know, when you introduced us to them and I saw that, it makes so much sense because I think people do make that leap automatically to, the great side. We ought to save the earth. We need to, minimize our impact, but you make a really great point. If someone's basic needs aren't met, they don't care because it's too important otherwise. And I mean, to give our listeners an idea where we're at. Today's June 2nd. And this is, after we've had these terrible incidents in Minnesota and the like. And this is all part of it. This is all related. And when people can't live in a safe society, they can't even think about it. So that's got to be first. So I like to see that in the goals.
Yeah. And that's how they start. And yeah, racial equity is a big part of that. And so I'm really glad that you brought that up.
Well, let's switch to Barron because you've been spending time and assessing how we're doing. Obviously we hired you because we wanted to get better, but what are we doing well? What do you see in our future? What do we have to do better at Barron in terms of sustainability too? How does it translate into the student experience?
It's a good question. Yeah, so we've been working on this last year on this campus assessment, which is about to be completed, and along the way developed a council of people that will help work with me to help us develop a master plan. What are we doing well? I think, we are a living laboratory, right? We're an open laboratory concept, and you really see that in the sustainability assessment. We have lots of opportunities for students with regard to civic engagement, student groups and activities, research that they can get involved in. We have a lot of support for underrepresented groups, and so we're doing really well in that area. And then our campus grounds, I mean, you can't escape that, right? We are an arboretum, and we have wonderful maintenance staff who keep our grounds so beautiful and really do it in with a conscientious mind to the fact that we are right on the Wintergreen Gorge, and hopefully we'll talk about that a little bit later. So those are the things we're doing well. There are, of course, other areas that we need to improve on, and that will be kind of the focus of developing this master plan for us moving forward.
It's really important to our students. I think they feel this, they understand it, but sometimes I think it's a little, it's a little difficult for them to know what they can do. So how are you seeing that connection with them going with, and are there student clubs and organizations in particular that have sought you out?
Absolutely. Well, we have Greener Barron is probably the most well-known of the student groups that's focused on environmental sustainability. We just started a new student group called LEAFS, which is focused on food security and food sustainability. I've also been reached out by Reef Watch, which is focused on basically water protections and life below water, focusing on that. And then a number of student groups that are involved in projects for classes that have reached out to me. So, one student group that was interested in creating kind of sustainability welcome bags, so that as students come to campus, arrive onto campus, we give them things like reusable bamboo ware and, you know, a stainless steel straw and a reusable bag so that they're not having to have so much disposability. Another group that was interested in putting up bat houses and beehives. And so, you know, as my position becomes more prominent, as this idea of sustainability becomes more prominent on campus, you have more and more students reaching out. And that's great. And working with them to make these kind of desires a reality is a big part of what I do.
And I think, like you said, we've got this kind of open laboratory environment, and they can see the changes. You know, one of the large discussions we ended up having was really driven by, you know, an international problem. That was, you know, the fact that our recycling waste, not a lot of people even knew, goes to China, right? Most people, they had no idea of that, by the way. They have no idea. They put it in their bins, they sort it, and they probably didn't know where it was going, and all good faith, right? And then China stopped buying it. This created this tremendous change and opportunity for discussion. Here in Erie, you know, they're not accepting glass anymore, even in the mainstream recycling. So anyways, I wanted to just get your thoughts on that and how that's changed. And, you know, what does the public really need to understand about recycling to make it more effective? Now, we'll stick with the home recycling right now.
That's a big question, Ralph.
I ask a really hard one.
It's good. I think, you know, people, we need to think more about our waste. I think that's step one, is, you know, that we do put it out at the curb and it disappears overnight, right? I mean, literally overnight it disappears. Yeah. And we, you know, it's somebody else's problem. But understanding the process by which our waste is recycled and taken care of, I think, is an important aspect. I wish everybody at some point in their life had to go out to a landfill and see what a landfill looks like, an operating landfill, in order to really have an appreciation for the quantity of trash that we produce as individuals and as a society, and what it looks like. You'd be shocked at when you go out to a landfill, you'd be shocked at what you see. You know, perfectly good things. And you're just like, I want to take this home because it's perfectly usable. And then, yeah, in terms of recycling, you know, it's that it, you know, the single stream recycling that has become the norm over the last, you know, 15 years, I think, has, you know, it was one of those best intentions, right? It was supposed to increase recycling rates, but in the process, you know, you really have to have that sorting part of it. So our single stream goes to a MRF, a mixed use recycling facility that's supposed to sort it out. But machines are not as good as people, and so they're not terribly effective. And that's part of the reason why China stopped accepting our, you know, largely plastic, because it was so highly contaminated. In fact, they will accept our plastic, but they wanted the contamination rate to be less than 0.5%, and I think what we were sending to them was about 30%.
Yeah.
So, and you can't blame them when there's that much contamination. You can't blame them for saying, we don't want your trash. So I think, you know, understanding what, and, you know, with regard to plastic, you know, it's a difficult material to recycle. So understanding that aspect too. And, you know, kind of being, I guess, more engaged in the whole process. But what I hope as a campus is to eventually make us a net zero campus, mm-hmm, or a zero waste campus, so that everything we make on campus is either composted or truly recycled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that, you know, you hit one of the points was this idea of single stream. People got enamored with it, and frankly, they throw things in there they shouldn't. And right, it's actually hard to blame the consumer, because there's a lot of different information out there. And I joke here in my house, it's you need a PhD in recycling sorting. to understand. And, you know, and on some containers, you can't read the numbers. It's not as well standardized as everyone would like it to be. But if you can get really good plastic and separate it out, it actually has a lot of value in the recycling stream, and it can be used over and over again. And that's what we want to have happen.
Absolutely.
But yeah, it's a difficult problem. And you made me think of, you made me think of actually my alma mater. I went to University of Arizona. You went to UT Austin. I went there for my graduate work, but we had actually a very famous researcher there, who studied garbage dumps. He was a garbologist, self-described
yes.
garbologist. You probably know who it is, you know, who it is. And I remember that well, and him, and this was back, you know, a number of years ago. I'll just say that, but we're leaving behind a legacy there, good, bad, or indifferent, mostly bad, I think. But if you've never been to a landfill to see what happens, like you say, it would surprise you. But he would find some interesting things, like, you know, by drilling down and coring and finding, you know, all sorts of stuff. I won't go on and on, but I always found that pretty fascinating. I want to switch now to microplastics. And I think the first time I met you, you told me you were the plastics lady. self-described, because of the work that you've done that's really important in identifying microplastics, particularly in our waterways, Great Lakes, and also the, you know, in our aquatic ecosystem. So let's talk a bit about that. What are microplastics? How do they get there?
So microplastics, by definition, is a piece of plastic that's smaller than 5 millimeters, which is about the size of your thumbnail, just to give people some perspective. It's not micro-sized in the kind of standard definition of what micro means, unfortunately, but that is the definition that is. So 5 millimeters or smaller, it's a long legacy as to why it became 5 millimeters, and we don't need to get into all of that. Where do they come from? You have primary and secondary microplastics. So primary microplastics are things that are manufactured to be that size. And so probably the most kind of, you know, kind of common thing that people think of are micro beads. So these were little plastic beads that were put into personal care products, face wash, body washes, in order to act as abrasives. They were, outlawed. They were regulated, right? In 2015 was when it was signed into law, and it became, a United States law in 2018. So, you should not be seeing microbeads in your personal care products anymore. Another kind of example of this are the pre-production pellets, where the nurdles that, how plastic is shipped from, its point of origin, a refinery, to its point of being turned into a consumer product, like many of the facilities we have here and around Erie. So that's another kind of place where you find something that's manufactured to be microplastics. The other type is the more common, and that's the secondary microplastics. So these form from larger plastic items that largely unintentionally end up released into the environment. Sun acts to make them more brittle, and then you have mechanical abrasion causing them to break into smaller and smaller pieces. But from a chemical standpoint, they're still plastic, right? So they just get smaller and smaller in terms of being a particle. And so that's, yeah, those are the most common type of microplastics.
And then fish and wildlife ingest them?
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a little bit of unintentional, right? You have a lot of filter feeding organisms that just kind of eat whatever. But a big portion of it seems to be, intentional in that, plastics, when they're in the environment, will pick up biofilms. So mm-hmm. little microorganisms will, live on the surface of the plastic, making it, appear to bigger organisms to be food, you know, to smell like food and look like food. And so they will ingest it.
And the extent of the problem, it's significant. I mean, you've tested here and, in our area, and I'm sure you're connecting to researchers all around the world. I mean, is it, it's all bodies of water for the most part? How pervasive is it?
It's everywhere. It's in our air. We're breathing microplastics. It's in our water. It's, you know, we've tested tap water. We've tested bottled water. We've tested beer. We've tested sea salt, you know. ocean water, fresh water, you know, there hasn't been, we've tested terribly remote lakes, you know, Antarctic sea ice. It all has microplastics in it. So it's a terribly pervasive problem. In fact, I was part of a United Nations working group, and, one of the UN, ambassadors came in and, you know, kind of welcomed everybody, right? And he said that this problem is so pervasive that the United Nations ranks it second only to climate change in terms of its ability to impact the survival of our species on this planet.
Wow. So how does this lead you to, what sort of research can we do at Barron? I mean, that's the, so we've got this problem. We have a plastics program too. I mean, one of the well-known ones in the world. So what's the opportunity for us to address it?
Well, it's multifaceted, right? I mean, we can go from the beginning of the plastics life cycle and understanding, you know, kind of thinking about maybe new materials that could be utilized. So bioplastics, for example, is maybe a possible alternative. We can be looking at the mechanics of it and how you make plastics. Maybe we could, you know, one of the things with plastics is that there's so many of them that recycling it makes it terribly difficult, right? And that's why you hear that ones and twos are the best plastics, because those are the most efficiently recycled. Well, is there a way to maybe allow us to kind of change the properties of those efficiently recycled plastics so that we can use them in a wider range of opportunities? So that we don't have this plethora of, you know, thousands of different plastics. If we could reduce the number of types of plastics, it would make it a lot easier to recycle them. And then we can be doing, you know, kind of basic research on the other end and kind of the end of life, and where do they end up and how do they biodegrade and, you know, what are things that we can be doing, on that side of the spectrum. So I think, you know, this really is an opportunity for cross-campus, interdisciplinary collaboration and a lot of opportunities for us to utilize this, to educate, as well as to make an impact on society.
So, you know, I'll put a little plug in for Barron. So a student who's interested though, they could come here and they could study chemistry, environmental science, the whole biology, and they could get involved with the work that you and your colleagues are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have a new program, right, starting up. Am I allowed to talk about that?
It's not official yet, but you can mention that it's on its way. We're well on our way. It will be approved in another month.
Oh, awesome. So, yeah, so we should be starting up soon a new polymer environmental science program that does exactly this. It bridges the plastics engineering technology program with the environmental science component and helps to train, you know, people who are kind of more environmentally minded around this plastics issue.
Yeah, we've just got this, you know, this is truly a grand challenge ahead of us. And, you know, plastics is a material and, you know, you look at it dispassionately. We need materials for our human function, right? And there's so many great things it does in the medical world, but now we're coming to grips with 30, 40 years of significant plastics consumption. And, it's not going away. It's how we're going to manage it and use less of it, but use it in a smarter way. And we're also seeing, you know, my background is engineering, not polymers, but for quite some time, we've just seen a much greater interest in the materials formulation and development. So all these pieces fit really well together. So, yeah, you can mention that. It's got its last hurdle for approval, which is the Board of Trustees meeting this July, and it's on the docket for that. So we're optimistic. Well, let's switch to the winner. You know, as you said early on, we've got all these beautiful assets here on campus. The Wintergreen Gorge, is phenomenal. We're just about completed with that project. So tell everybody what's going on. What's this Wintergreen Gorge project? And by the way, I don't even think a lot of people know that the Wintergreen Gorge is that's Penn State property,
Penn State,
but they will
property.
Now.
Yeah. I know. It's such a beautiful area. People, I think, automatically assume that it's like a public park, but it's not. It's Penn State property. And, you know, I think it's such a feather in our cap that we have this asset and we make it very available to the larger community, to the extent that we've, you know, taken on this endeavor to restore it and protect it for future generations. So it's incredible. It started, I guess, in 2013, I want to say, with an assessment of, you know, what's going on with the Wintergreen Gorge? What are its issues and how would we protect it? And so we came up with the sustainability, Wintergreen Gorge Sustainability Master Plan. We have a lot of erosion issues happening within the gorge. And this master plan was laid out to help kind of protect these natural wetlands, to protect the area and make it accessible for people. That master plan came out in 2015, and then we spent four years as a campus, writing grants, pulling together resources from a number of different agencies, including the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, the Pennsylvania Department of Community and Economic Development, the Erie County Planning Department, as well as our own campus resources, Penn State resources, to start the implementation of this master plan. And so the project that we're finishing up right now is phase one of that master plan. And it's really exciting. It's amazing what has been done down there.
Now, I'm impressed. I walk the campus a lot and I walk through the gorge, and particularly during this COVID crisis, what an asset for the community. The number of people who are down there in the gorge, walking around campus, it's just been wonderful to see. But as it turns out, I was down there the other day and I saw the signs were up for the first time and unveiled at the trailhead. And it's beautiful. So my kudos to the whole team, but also the whole pathway there that you start and walk along the stream. Just changed the whole look of it as well, in my opinion. And it feels so much different than it did 6 months ago, a year ago.
Absolutely. And it's all ADA accessible, which I think is so incredibly important. I just moved my mother-in-law, up here to Erie, Pennsylvania. And, and she has trouble walking, you know, and if prior to these improvements, she wouldn't have been able to go out there. And, I'm just really excited to be able to take her out there and have her experience, that space. I know people that have had similar experiences. So it's great.
Well, we are coming to the end of our time. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Oh, goodness, a million and a half things I want to add. We didn't have enough time to talk about nearly enough stuff. But I'll just end with this, that, with everything that's going on, the coronavirus and the kind of protests and things that are happening, I just really want to remind people that they should be the change they wish to see in the world. These are wonderful. It's my favorite quote that I live by from Gandhi. As we make changes and as we are the examples of what we want to see, it affects everything else that's around us. So really encourage people to do that.
Well, that is great wisdom. That's a great way to end the show. Thank you. I really appreciate you joining us. And again, Dr. Sim Sherry Mason, Sustainability Coordinator, Penn State Barron. Thanks for joining us today, Sam.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.